I liked, and I've been doing this work in collaboration with Pierre, Ligisella, and Donny Bernard, who are here, and we have a preprint up on ConMed that talks about this work. So, let me tell you a little bit about the goals. Like I said, I'm first going to tell you a little bit about real experiment and why people are interested in spin glasses. So I'm going to presume that some people don't know anything about spin glasses, so I'd like to make excuses to other people for going through that again, and talk about some of their real physical properties. We're going to talk about a model system. I'm going to talk about kind of accepted wisdom about this model system in two aspects. One is what happens when we take very large systems, and also what are the important geometric objects. Those geometric objects are the things that we're going to be discussing in the last part, where I'm going to describe some numerical experiments that we have done. And this is numerics, but we've been trying to be very careful about it, doing lots of samples, trying to ask the right questions. And so, of course, what we're trying to do here is pose a challenge to people to explain why this system, which has quenched disorder in it, it's very different from ordinary critical systems that have been talked about, like percolation and ISE models, why it might have conformal invariance in the domain Markov property, why SLE will describe it. And I'll show you the evidence and describe what SLE means for the system as we go along here. So let's start with the real thing. So alloy, that's a material. It's made up of two metals. And we have here copper, which is a non-magnetic species, mixed up with manganese. That's a magnetic species. And this is one of the first systems in which spin glass behavior was seen. And what happens is you have these atoms that are randomly distributed around. And sometimes they like to line up their spins depending upon the distance they are apart, in which case it's a ferromagnetic interaction. And sometimes they like to anti-align. So these purple bonds are supposed to show forces or interactions that want the spins to point in opposite directions. And the blue bonds are supposed to show interactions between neighboring magnetic spins where they want to line up in the same direction. And we're going to take just simple up-down spins for the remainder of this talk. Those are more complex things. They point in any direction, for example. But for this talk, we're going to use what are called ISE spins, which can be up or down. Now, the point here is there's competition between different energies. So some spins want to line up, but another spin could be telling them that they actually want to anti-align. And this competition is what leads to very slow dynamics. So though these spins are flipping around the order of 10 to the 12th, or many tens of tens, 10 to the 10th times per second, experiments are done over week-long time scales, 10 to the 17th times longer time scales, showing that the dynamics of these systems are extremely slow. It takes very long time for the system to settle down. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about two experiments one can do. One can take this block of material, cool it down very slowly, and heat it up slowly. And while you do so, you measure the magnetic response. And it's some part of the magnetic response, the imaginary part of the magnetic response, the autophase component. And as you cool, that magnetic response decreases. So think of this as temperature, field interaction, paralysis. Switch. Good. Perfect timing. Okay. So we had here. You have temperature, and you have this magnetic response, which I'll write as chi double prime. Now, as you cool the system down, it does this. The response decreases slowly with temperature. As you heat it back up, it increases. Nothing terribly exciting. But what happens if you cool, you pause, and you measure the magnetic response in the system, it slowly drops with time at fixed temperature. And then you start cooling again, and it perks back up. It goes back up to where it would have been if you cooled at a constant rate. This is called aging, this slow decay here, and this is called rejuvenation. It gets refreshed, it gets woken back up again as you cool it down. It forgets that you paused down here. Now, so that tells you what aging is. This is rejuvenation. As you heat it back up, you'll find that the magnetic response dips again on the way back up. It remembers the temperature at which you paused at. It's a really remarkable property. You can burn the temperature into the object. It knows what temperature you paused at. And that again results from some of these slow dynamics. And how that exactly works is still a matter of debate, but the objects I'm going to tell you about, these domain walls, are related to understanding this behavior. So let me show you one more experiment here. This is a slightly more complicated experiment, where the experimentalist dropped the temperature, waited a while, dropped the temperature. So this is temperature versus time. I'm sure it's hard to see back there. But this is a step function, it's kind of staircase set of steps where they pause and they cool, they pause. So they cool, they pause, they cool, they pause, they cool, they pause. So each time they pause, this response decays, and then when they cool it down, it jumps back up. And they can burn, and they can do this like four or five times, and when they heat up, the system, this block of material, remembers each temperature at which you paused at. And so you can store very complicated information in this random alloy. So as these slow relaxation, this aging, this rejuvenation of memory. And this type of thing is a real strong motivation for physicists to understand what's going on in these materials and to build models of it. Yes?
If you cool at a constant rate, but in a different rate, do you get the same curve?
You get a slightly different curve, right? So if you cool more slowly, you'll get a slight, it'll be offset slightly. So it's not in equilibrium. It's clearly not in equilibrium. Of course, you know, Lord's going to say this. Okay. So to study these systems, theoretical physicists have made several caricatures of the competition between the different spins in these systems.
But can you say again, what's the vertical?
It's chi double prime, it's the magnetic susceptibility, the out-of-phase part. What you do is you apply a magnetic field that oscillates up and down in time, and it has a response, and you measure that response, and it has an in-phase part that has the same phase, and it has an out-of-phase part. This is the magnitude of the out-of-phase part of that. Yes?
So when it's in that well there,
yes.
If you either cool it or you heat it, the magnetic thing goes up.
Right, that's right. Either way.
And does it have the memory over many cycles of heating and cooling, or just...
Oh, if you heat it up, if you heat it up enough, I mean, like, if you heat it back up to here, you cool down, it will have forgotten the lower temperature. And that's a clue as to what's going on. It has to do with growing domains. And the domain structure changes with temperature, as I'll talk about. So this is a physical, real physical experiment, real data. Now let's move into theory land. So here's an Edwards Anderson model where we're going to take a very simple model here, which is still controversial and not understood in all its aspects. We have spins on, say, a lattice. In this case, I'll take a finite dimensional lattice, a grid graph type of thing. We have plus or minus ones assigned to each node of the graph. And there's an energy function, which is given by summing over pairs of nearest neighbors, the product of the SIs and the JIJ, where JIJ is some random variable that sits on each bond that connects the nearest neighbor spins. And it's just their Gaussian, say, with a zero mean. The variance doesn't matter, you can scale that out. Now, what's going to be important for the rest of this talk is you can study this at finite temperature and do partition functions and all the things in statistical physics that statisticians like to do with things at finite temperature. But in this case, it turns out if you're at low enough temperature, its exact temperature doesn't matter. It's believed that the thermal fluctuations due to temperature do not affect the behavior of the system. And the statics, it will change the dynamics, as we've talked about, but also, as you change T, it actually modifies the effect of JIJ, it turns out. But if you sit at a fixed temperature, what's useful to do then is to study the minima of H. We're going to look at ground states. Yeah, Ilya?
Oh, just
speak
with the three-dimensional.
Yes, okay, good. Thank you, I thought of mentioning that, but I was going to avoid that. Yes, I'm going to be doing two dimensions, and this is strictly true only in three dimensions, but I'm going to be working, two dimensions I'm going to find it, you know, it's the only place you're going to find SLE. 3D is hard to study, and here a lot of the behavior at zero in two dimensions apparently replicates what happens in three dimensions below the glass transition. At finite temperature, it's not a spin glass in two dimensions. That's right. There's an important point. Temperature is not irrelevant in two dimensions, it turns out. That's very important. I was trying to avoid discussing that, though. Ask me again if it becomes important, and I'll try to justify it. We believe we can do a lot in two dimensions to study real spin glasses. And some of these results I'm going to tell you about apply, Okay, so here, what does the ground state of this look like? These are random numbers. So what's the structure of the ground state? They have random signs. So here's a sample ground state. Since the state is alpha with spins SI0, I generated this using a random number generator. Okay, you could solve actually for a real JIJ, but it doesn't matter. The statistics of the ground state are white noise. They're uncorrelated variables.
Wait a minute. So black and whites are the spins.
Thank you. Yes. So the black and whites, these are the spins. Okay, actually I'll pause here for a second. The white is say spin up, black is spin down, or vice versa. So plus or minus ones are indicated by here. The spins lie on a triangular lattice, and the dual lattice is going to be this, the bonds dual, which are going to become important here. These bonds here on the honeycomb are going to cross the bonds dual to the interaction. So I'm going to look here at spins on a triangular lattice, and these are the spins. There are two ground states in any finite system. With Jij is Gaussian, the continuous value, except for very measure zero accidental degeneracies, there's going to be exactly two minimizers of the energy, alpha and beta. We just flip plus one to minus one.
How about,
can you say a word about boundary conditions?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I will say a good bit about boundary conditions. I'm going to look at two cases here, so I might as well mention them now. I'm going to do open boundary conditions, where the spins are just, they just have no connections to the outside world. I'm going to do periodic boundary conditions where I'm going to have me turn this into a cylinder like this. And I'm going to do into a cylinder.
So it's still free on the
ends. Right, not fully periodic. There's several reasons for that. One is the algorithms are much harder for fully periodic. And also we can, there's some questions about, I mean it's much harder actually just numerically to do fully periodic.
But if you fix the boundary condition by setting the spins at the boundary,
mm-hmm.
and solve for the results of ground state, does it look anything like the ground states that you get with
yes.
So it has, you could.
I'll deal with that in detail in a moment, but the short answer is yes. So if you wrap it like this, that'll be one thing, and then that'll be periodic, and then I'll just define the anti-periodic in a moment, the standard anti-periodic. Okay, but for this picture, it doesn't matter. Yes, question? So I'm going to ask two questions about this system. One is, addressing what Lincoln was asking in particular, is what happens as you take a large sample? Are there still two states? I've made this claim, and it's a subtle one, and I should be putting credits up here. I've left off some also. Newman and Stein in particular have looked at this question and tried to define, make some definitions about what would happen in the finite infinite volume limit, among others, and to study there's a variety of rigorous and non-rigorous results out there on what happens as L goes to infinity. And nothing's known rigorously about 2D, though there are lots of strong arguments that will support the new merits I'll present. And related to that is what is the effect of boundary conditions on these states. So the states look random, but they're going to be sensitive to boundary conditions, and that's where the information will come in. But to do that a little bit, let me give you a little bit of details how we're going to describe these systems. Now, it turns out, as I said, there are two ground states, but if you write these variables, Fij, which are the Jijs, times, and we're assuming Jij is not zero, hardly ever, so it's not going to matter. You can map these back and forth, except up to a sign. The Sisjs we'll put in as a product, and these are going to be defined on bonds that connect neighboring spins. The bonds dual to it, so these are the things that are going to lie on the edges of the honeycomb lattice. The Fijs are going to lie here, and they're going to be defined for the Jijs that connect to neighboring spins.
So you think of the Jijs as having some continuous distribution?
The continuous distribution. They're Gaussian variables. Independent Gaussian. Each one has a random.
Bimodal
is a different story. Yes, bimodal. If they're plus or minus one, the story changes. So we believe, actually, if you want to try to model finite temperature real spin glasses, your continuous distribution is the right thing, because any bimodal couplings would get renormalized to continuous coupled distribution anyway. So we're going to start with the continuous distribution.
So it doesn't matter.
But there's a question of discrete versus bimodal.
Right.
I can imagine two Gaussians, one peak at a positive and another peak at a negative value.
Right.
That's what I call bimodal versus plus minus
right.
J.
Right. The belief would be as long as this continues, it doesn't matter which distribution is on, neglecting tails and all that nice stuff. But okay. So we're going to define these variables Fij. If you invert all the spins, then the Fijs, of course, remain constant. You multiply the Si's by Sj's, Si's all get multiplied by minus one, and Fij doesn't change. So therefore, you take something where you have two ground states, and you convert it into a one state system, a finite system. And what's going to be important is if you take a cluster of spins. You flip all the spins inside that cluster. Around the edge, the FIJs will change sign because the bonds that cross the boundary of the set will have spins that change the different sign on the two sides. So if I take a little bit of alpha and paste it into a bit of beta, I'll create a wall, a bubble, or a loop on the boundary of that set where the FIJs will be reversed, and I will change the energy by this amount. So you can take a spin configuration, a set of SIs, and compute the energies, which is just the sum of the FIJs. So if you reverse the FIJs, you just, on some boundary, you change the energy by that much. Any questions? Okay, so let me spend just a moment telling you about, I'll save that for a question. I'll save it just in case. Sorry. Question is there is an algorithm for solving for the ground state of the system. It's a non-trivial algorithm. You have to take your original graph, you have to change it into a much more complicated graph, then use a general matching algorithm to solve the ground state, which we steal from other people, because we don't write our own general matching algorithm, but we have hard enough time writing the mappings between the graphs in order to feed it to a matching routine. And then it turns out, and this is probably seen here by now, the very important property of the ground state for the FIJs is that there are no loops which have negative weight of the FIJs. So if I go around the boundaries of the hexagons, because then I could flip the spins inside that loop and lower the energy because of that change in delta H would be negative. So there are no contractible paths or loops that have negative weight. But there might be a path from the top to the bottom that has negative weight. That will become important. Okay, so some of this will become more use in a moment. Let me go back and talk about a slightly simpler problem, which is, you know, does the thermodynamic limit exist, a large volume limit exist? What I did numerically is, for example, a 2D spin glass and some other two-dimensional disorder systems and 3D systems, is you solve for the ground state on a system of size L. So you take some grid of size L by L, you solve for the ground state using some matching algorithm or whatever. Then you add new spins and random bonds on the outside while keeping the inside fixed and solve for the ground state again. And then you compare the FIJs on their common area here, and you get some picture like this. You'll get domain walls and loops that are on the edges, that connect the edges up, where the ground states differ. And then what you do is you look in a box of some fixed size W and you ask about how does the probability that the FIJs will change in such that the path in which they change will cross this box of size W as you make L and L prime large. So the question is here, so it's very, you know, for physicists it's very, very standard, and for statistical physics it's very standard. You take a box, you put a big box around it, you change the boundary conditions, or you make the box larger. Whatever it is, you keep on successfully growing the box in some way and see what happens on the interior. See if the correlation functions in the interior converge, is what you're asking in this case. And so if the FIJs don't change inside this box, then this box may be flipping between alpha and beta, but it's essentially not changing as you take the large volume limit. And the numerics show, at least strongly suggest, you can't see numerics show, the numerics really strongly suggest that as L becomes large, the probability of a path crossing the interior scales just as you might expect with D minus DF, where DF is this fractal dimension that will for these types of paths. And the fact that goes to zero as L goes to infinity means that you converge to a constant, a unique ground state as you go to the large volume limit. So there isn't evidence for multiple states or hierarchically organized states in the sense of many states in the volume limit.
Can you explain why the ground state goes to zero
instead of the ground state? Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by the state in the infinite volume limit. The standard definition is you say, do the correlation functions, do the whatever, these spins, how they're related to each other in theory, do they depend, is there a well-defined thermodynamic limit, and is it unique?
So this would be for any finite size correlation.
Right. Right.
Not in the strongest sense of like this unique state in the image, right?
Well,
in some kind of
for any arbitrarily larger the separated spins, you take the volume go to infinity, yeah. The correlation functions converge.
Okay, but it's not in the revolution sense.
No, no, look, there's always a weak limit.
Right.
Yes, there always is, right.
And now the question is it just one limit, or one limit at its spin reverse?
Think this is enough to show that it's one?
I don't know if there's exact proof, like says, how many, I mean, is it?
But you don't, you have just demonstration that the interfaces don't intersect the inner box.
Right.
But if you could prove something like that, then yeah, I'd say that you could probably prove that there's a unique.
I have to go over it again. A lot of this work comes from Newman and Stein that I can't recall all their arguments and which part is exactly rigorous and which is not rigorous.
I
look at the papers.
It depends on the actual power. It's not enough to just do the best in the question.
Okay. Okay. Well, as long as it goes to zero, I don't
think
know.
As long as it goes to zero, it's fine.
Why am I not? Okay, so now let's go back to the cylinder. So that was with the open boundary conditions. Let's now go back to the cylinder and generate domain walls. And we're going to do that by solving for the ground state for the cylinder. And then we're going to take a. Now, here, these are actually showing the spins again. So this is dual to what I was showing you before. So these are the FIs lying on the hex on the honeycomb lattice. These are the spins. And if you change the Jij along some column, you force the products of the Fijs around the loop to change. And so this is the standard periodic to anti-periodic boundary conditions, where you put a twist into the system. You force the system to change on large scales. And so by changing the Jijs, what you do is you introduce a path in the Fijs that's different. This gamma here shows where the Fijs change sign between the two sets of Jijs. And it's actually the shortest path from the bottom to the top through this graph of Fijs in the original periodic ground state. And it's the shortest path, which includes possibly negative weights. And the energy of the domain wall then is twice the sum of the Fijs, just like before. Yes?
You understand that we have no control over where it starts and where it ends. Is it true or not?
I can control it, or I can let it be free, whichever I like. And I'll do both here.
Okay,
what I'm about to go to. How can I control it? There are several ways. The way I do it is I directly go to this. There's a graph that's kind of decorated like Castellan and Fisher cities type of thing. Maybe. Anyway, so I modify the graph that I do the general matching on. Another way you can do it is you could solve for the ground state, and then you can reverse the sign of this bond. You could set the Jijs to force a flip in the relative spins on the two sides to start the domain wall there if you wanted to do it. That's one way to do it. It's a cruder way to do it. So you can say, find the ground state, and if these spins are lined up, put in a negative bond of very high weight, and that'll force the domain wall to start there. Sorry?
By shortest path, you mean it's weighted by Fij?
Yes, by it's the shortest path, and just you're minimizing the sum along gamma of the Fijs.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I mean by shortest path. Shortest path and the weighted, shortest weighted path, yes. Okay, and so I'll do L rows of W spans. I'll try varying the shape of the cylinder quite a bit to try out different things. So here's what a domain wall, typical domain wall, looks like. There's a very wide sample, it's probably about 1,000 or so across. And this is a domain wall. So on this side it's locally like alpha, and on the other side it's beta. I mean, it's a little tricky to find if you wrap around. But you have the two ground states separated by a domain wall. Like in the Ising model, you have upspin separated from downspins. Here you have these two random looking states separated by a domain wall. And Philly's already asked me that question. So I can solve it for either this domain wall being anywhere along the cylinder's edge, or I can fix it at a particular point. Okay, so there's what might be almost called classical type of picture now for based upon Braymore and McMillansworth on what's called a domain wall renormalization group, or droplet theory by Fisher and Hughes, which says that the energy of the domain wall should scale as some power of the size. So the total length of that domain wall, and the total weight of the domain wall energy, the sum of the Fijs, and the total length should scale as some dimension, L to some dimension, like a fractal dimension. And it turns out that in two dimensions, this number is negative, which is why the zero temperature or fixed point is unstable. Why if you turn on a little bit of temperature, things change. Let me point out something here, though, that this is for unconstrained endpoints. If you fix the endpoint, you actually cost order unit energy, and you get something, you get data that's effectively zero, which changes the things, as we'll see. So what we'd like to do is to test the conformal invariance of these paths, the domain Markov. Now, I must have mentioned there's work by Hartmann, Amoruso, Hastings, and Moore on, they were the ones to first suggest that there was conformal invariance and possibly a domain Markov property as well. And we looked at that question in further detail, but they should be credited for starting this. But what we're going to do in particular is we're going to look at comparison with some other things that are known to be in SLE or apparently are not in SLE type of picture, like a loop-race random walk. And we're going to apply the same data analysis path. We're going to apply the same techniques to these just as one of the checks on our data. And so numerically, for example, we find that the fractal dimension is 1.250 for the loop-race random walk, which is not surprising. It's supposed to be that. But we do walks where we have absorbing boundary conditions. That is where a walk cannot return to the line it started from. So you do a random walk on the, say, on the strip, and you erase loops. And if you absorb, you have either absorbing boundary conditions where you're not allowed to return to the initial line, you throw away those paths, or you can bounce off the bottom line. And we consider both cases, just as a check, because we always see the effects of boundary conditions on various measurements, we find the same fractal dimension in both cases. The length of the path goes like to the 5/4 power, at least numerically, for both boundary conditions. Does anyone prove that? Yes, for reflecting boundary conditions?
So what do you mean by reflecting?
So on the lattice.
Would it have stopped at a finite time?
When it hits a particular height, I stop it.
Well, then basically the last piece of it looks like loop race block.
Right, so you're saying that dominates it. But even near the start, it looks the same. Right, so on all scales, it looks the same.
And the excursion.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. I agree. Okay. I mean, that's what I expect. I just didn't know how rigorously that was known. So here's one of the tests we do. We look at the cylinder and we make the cylinder very long. If SLE or conformal field theory type of picture applies, where there's a relationship between the fractal dimension and this number kappa in SLE, you can predict the winding number. That is if you start here and you measure between the end point and where you started, how much you wind around the cylinder, the variance of that should go as kappa times the length of the cylinder if you have 2 pi circumference. So if you normalize things properly, you can compute kappa. So I'll call this kappa cylinder. So from the numerics, if you just plot, this is actually the distance, but we convert that into angle as a function of length. And these are the data points up to 800 long systems. This is for W equals 32, so there's 32 lattice units along here and 800 along here. And fitting to the variance, fitting a linear dependence of the variance gives us a kappa, quite consistent with the fractal dimension for the system. And that's independent of the boundary condition, whether you do fixed or free, because once you get away from the ends, it doesn't know about the boundaries in this case, apparently.
That graph is done by the winding number?
Yes. So it's a graph of the winding number versus length of the cylinder. And this is for the spin glass. We also checked it for the loop race random walk, which is surprisingly Yeah, there are finite size effects, but they're apparently quite small. You notice I'm only fitting down here to L equals 100, which is 3 times. It's usually about 3 to 5 times. When L is 3 to 5 times the circumference is when you start to see finite size effects and the end effects kick in. And there, that'll be boundary condition dependent.
You should say we see a nice Gaussian distribution.
Oh yeah, there's a nice Gaussian distribution for the data. Not only is it about the right variance, it's a nice fit for Gaussian.
I guess I was thinking more about the 32
the width. Oh yeah, the lattice effects then. Yeah, I go to 16, I don't see much difference. 8 or something like that, I'll see a difference. I can look over that data and discuss it with you. There are finite size effects in that sense, yes. 32 is apparently large enough. Okay, and again, of course, as many of you know, there's a very precise prediction from SLE, at least, that if this process were to, so this minimal path that goes across the system, this is an optimization problem. This is not a statistical mechanics problem on the face of it. It's an optimization problem. If you follow this path and you ask, what is the probability of it passing to the right or left of a particular point at angle phi, there's a formula for that. And we're going to compare that with what we expect for different kappas. So here, this plot here, let me explain this plot for a second. So this is actually, because the differences are small, the cumulative probability as a function of angle is some sort of S-shaped function like this. And if what I do is I actually subtract off here the prediction for kappa equals 2, which is this simple function here, from the cumulative probability. So this is the probability that the path will pass to the left or the right of a given angle. So this is the angle over pi. This is out to pi here. And we subtract off the data from that expected for kappa equals 2, just so we can magnify small differences and see them. This is the data here for a couple of different system sizes, the probability to pass left or right of a particular point, given that it's an unconstrained n. It's a floating n. So we do this effectively. We do it on a strip, but we look closely enough that it looks like the half plane, and we look at the path, and we see the probability of passing to the left or right of a particular point. And it's consistent with what we'd expect for. These dashed lines here show kappa of about 2.16 through 2.32. So kappa in this range from 2.16 to 2.32 would give these values. So it's consistent with something about 2.24 roughly for kappa, this angular distribution. So it looks again consistent from that. So we're just trying to try out different tests here and see what works and what doesn't. This is if we fix one end. So you get a different effect of kappa if you fix one end. So it looks like there's a real kappa there, but it's not the one you would expect based upon the fractal dimension. So you can fix the domain wall to be at a particular point, or you can let it float. It makes a difference in these disordered systems because there's fixed variables. If you're looking at the percolation or the Ising model or something, it doesn't matter whether you fix it or not because there's no because everything's homogeneous. There's no broken translation invariance.
So I think that is a boundary.
Like this,
you would measure C, but you would measure C minus 0.4 times.
Okay, so yeah, we'd be glad to. So yeah, there's something, right, there's something like, say, like polygonry operators that are somehow changing the effect of. Sorry, it's not changing the fractal dimension. I guess there's like things. The long scale of distance, it says the long scale behavior on one scale, it says the fractal dimension. Okay, but the point is, it just so that could be. So another thing we can do is we can use these dipolar, look at dipolar SLE like Bernard and Bauer developed for our path. So here's our original domain wall. Where is it? Yes, this is. Wow, it should be this black one here. This is our original domain wall here. And we start unfolding it, unzipping it using this sequence of maps that would be appropriate to SLE for dipolar geometry. To extract the Brownian motion putatively for the SLE type process. So as we apply this sequence of maps, we, usual thing, we do the slit type of map where we look at the first point in here and apply the map that pulls out that first point, pulls the curve down onto the real axis, and shifts it over accordingly. And this is how things change with time for a sequence of unfoldings of the map. And if we look at the variance of that, and here what I've actually plotted is the variance squared at time 2t minus the variance squared at time t of the, so you compute, you take it, let me start back up to the one, you take a Jij, you compute the ground state for periodic boundary conditions, you compute the ground state for anti-periodic boundary conditions, you take the difference, you get a curve, then you take that curve and you convert it into a C of t, then you throw away that sample, you're done with it, you can't do anything more with it, you generate a new sample, you repeat the process. So this is an average over many samples of C squared at time 2t minus C squared of t divided by t, which if it's a diffusive process should go to a constant with time. And you can see here we have about 3 decades or so to where things are lying within a pretty narrow band consistent with our other predictions of kappa. So kappa here is again about, this should be, let's see here, it's about 232, 236 in here, roughly consistent. Certainly consistent within our numerical uncertainties. I think C's look very Gaussian. We've looked at the distribution of C's. Now, by correlated, I mean correlated in time. So you generate this trace of C of T. They have only very short-range correlations. I don't think this is a definitive test, but it's at least that doesn't break at that point. And this is for fixed boundary conditions. Just, again, we get a different result that's consistent, roughly, with what we got for the angle, but it's different from what you expect from the fractal dimension. So we have this number that looks like kappa is about 2.32. Don't know why it's 2.32. If someone can prove why it should be around there, that would be great. It's a challenge to take home. Okay. Here, this is just something. Actually, there's a recent, I haven't read in detail, this preprint by Kennedy where he looks at, it measures various things and shows also that C of T is not the best way to test things. Here's for a minimal spanning tree. If you, it looks like the effect of kappa, again, the variance, the mean variance divided by time, plateaus over a long range, but it doesn't plateau to the right value, and minimal spanning tree doesn't appear to be described by SLV. So, okay, so another thing that, if there's going to be SLE, is besides the conformal invariance, we're going to do a slightly more detailed test. So there's the domain Markov property, which, again, is, let me just remind people what it is. So if you have a, let's say, and here let's, I'm going to do a couple of different versions of this. Let's do it like this, gamma 1. And this is A, B, C. So the probability that on the original domain D, that if you condition on the path starting with gamma 1, which connects A to C, that you see gamma 2, should be the same as the probability that on the cut domain, where you remove gamma 1, if the path starts here, so you condition on the path starting here, the probability that it ends as gamma 2 should be the same in two cases. So that's what the domain Markov property says. And this property must fail for the spin glass. It just doesn't work. Okay, so what's going on here?
It does
fail.
You can explicitly show it.
You can explicitly show it by example that it fails.
Exactly. So why do you say it must fail? It does fail.
It does fail. Okay. I'm just quoting someone else who I was talking to who said it must fail. And I go, yeah, you're right, it must fail. So, right. It does fail. Right. But it does fail, but we're going to test it anyway. And we're going to test it for larger systems. So you can show in small systems that it must fail, and we can, in fact, can see that in small systems it must fail. But we're trying larger systems to see if it still fails. I mean, it will fail, but how badly does it fail? So what we do is we generate a bunch of paths. So here's like what I just drew. We do a system that's like, say, 7 rows of spins here. So 6 rows of spins. We generate 4 million samples or so and find the ground states. And then we compute the various probabilities. We say, so on this original strip, we compute the domain walls. And we find, look at those that start with the given gamma 1 and ask, what is the probability that it will end with gamma 2? Otherwise, what we can do is we can say, well, I'm going to fix gamma 1 to be some starting path. I'm going to clip these bonds So the domain wall cannot go through these bonds. And then I'm going to compute the domain wall. Now the domain wall might be over here. I throw those away. If the domain wall ends here, I keep that and I accumulate the statistics for gamma 2.
And you generate the different domain walls by monkeying around at the top differently?
I twist it, I make it periodic versus anti-periodic in this direction. So this is for free conditions now, not constraining anything except for possibly the shape of the start of the path.
Oh, when you say I throw away the ones that don't hit, you mean I throw away the samples of JIJs in which they don't hit?
Yes, I throw away those samples.
Okay, sorry.
Right, I throw away those samples. And so I'm going to have P, and P is going to be given gamma 1, what's the probability of it, and even gamma 2 in the original domain, and P prime is going to be the probability that if it starts at C in the cut domain, that it terminates with gamma 2. Okay, here's one way to present the data, actually a couple different ways to present the data. These are numerical experiments, I'm just seeing what works. This is gamma 2, so I take all the possible gamma 2s, you know, several thousand of them for a system of this size, and I lay them out in lexicographic order. That is, I order them by their names, like left, right, left, or something like this, whatever it works out to be. And then I lay them all out, and I compute P and P prime for each of those cases. And this is for the Ising-Spin glass with 6x6 sample, where gamma 1 is a particular choice. This one I go up, and then I go right, left, right on the honeycomb lattice, and then I look at all the gamma 2s, and this is the type of thing I get for the most popular gamma 2s. And here's out in the tails. So we're down to very small probabilities here. You know, so there's a lot more error, but generally these two sets of data are following each other quite precisely within numerical error. So in that sense, it looks like a domain Markov property is being satisfied at this level of testing. Yes?
Why is there such huge drops in this component?
This is essentially the length of gamma 2. So you could go up very directly, and those are the most probable paths, it turns out. Actually, I mean, there's fewer of them, but they have a higher probability.
But this huge gap, I mean, it's like not a continuous distribution.
Right. That's because I'm looking at small systems. So these are like the ones of length 3. These are the ones of length 5 that connect. So some of these double back, and so they become much less probable. And they're separated by their lengths. And that's what, in lexicographic order, emphasizes that. Right? A becomes before aardvark in the dictionary.
Yeah, if you took L to infinity, then it should be somehow a smooth function.
Right. That's right. Yeah, it's hard for me to work on an infinite lattice. Some things you can do on an infinite lattice, this one I can't do. Okay, so now let's go back to some of our test cases. This is a loop erased random walk with absorbing boundary conditions, which should obey SLE, and it should obey, of course, in particular, the domain Markov property. And you see there's a very similar comparison. So here again is gamma 2, that's P and P prime. We have the different colors for the two sides of the equation. And here they're lining up with each other very well at the small probability, the low probability, and the high probability levels both.
This is something that satisfies it at the discrete level.
Yep, absolutely. Right. Okay. So I'm just using. I need comparisons. If I just present the Ising-Spin glass data, you say, well, is this better than or worse than things that we really know something about?
So it's numerically doing something. You know the answer.
Okay. Right. So I have to test a hypothesis.
Yeah. Okay.
I can't prove it, but I can test it. But this is with reflecting boundary conditions. You see that the P and the P prime don't line up with each other. Breaks the domain Markov property just as you'd expect it to do, but here you have numerical evidence of how it breaks the domain Markov property.
Okay. When you say reflecting, does that mean if you did the slip domain, you would then reflect off the other way?
No, that's why it's not. That's why it's not Markov, right? You don't reflect it. You do loop erasing. So reflecting means, you know, let me just be clear about this because I think there could be a chance for confusion about it. So let's do it on the lattice where I know how to do it. I actually do it on the same type of lattice so they can compare things most precisely. You know, if I'm doing a loop erase random walk, if I do that, well, I erase the loop and I continue with my random walk until I get up to the top.
Okay.
And if I ran into the bottom, I say, oh, I'm not supposed to do that. I better erase all the way back to the origin and start again.
Okay.
That's absorbing. And then if reflecting means, well, if I go to the bottom, if I try to go to the bottom, I bounce back. I mean, you have to work it out so that on this lattice, actually, at this point, you're not allowed to go here. So you're not allowed to cross here, but you don't throw away the path. If you cross, you try again. That's something about reflecting boundary conditions.
Go back over to the bottom.
You reflect back the probability line. Right. So you try different various things. And that breaks the conformal invariance, or at least the domain markup part, because the boundary here is different than the path.
So you reflect on the whole trajectory, right?
I reflect as many times as is necessary, except the only thing, I erase loops, but otherwise
yeah,
I reflect until I get to the top levels, and then I stop.
Comic explorer.
On the horizontal boundary, not
yeah.
on the path itself.
It
doesn't reflect up.
On the path, it's comic explorer. It's not
yes.
like that. Because it's not.
I'm not reflecting off the path. Right, that would be a harmonic explorer. Right. Okay. Here's an alternative way to present the data, just for a different way of looking at it. This is the last thing I'll show you, so I'll just take a moment to explain this. So I look at the ratio of P prime over P. So I look at P prime over P, because I want to see how much they differ. What's the worst case thing? So P prime and P are very different. I'm breaking the Markov property. Very much. So if I take the ratio of P prime over P and call it R, this is the cumulative probability distribution where I'm using the measure given by the probability of gamma 1 and gamma 2 on the original domain. So I'm summing over all gamma 1s and gamma 2s where the ratio between P prime and P is less than R. So this is a cumulative probability distribution. And if the Markov property holds, domain property holds, it should be a step function. For reflecting loop or ace random walk, can see that this shows a non-step function, which is again is an indication of the breakdown of domain markup property, because you want the ratios to be all equal to one. So this is a cumulative probability distribution, and there'd be a step. And for the spin glasses, well, you know, there's a few out there that are a little bit different. And certainly in finite systems, you see that. And we're doing larger systems to see how this changes with system size. Understand that better. They're actually, just because there's a random variable, there will always be tails. This data is kind of sorted, so they will emphasize such effects, actually. Those types of things give their tails of distribution, which can be emphasized in a finite sample. Okay. So we've done several measures of a kind of a kappa effective, like looking at the cylinder, looking at the angle distribution for these domain walls in the Ising spin glass. They're consistent with the measured fractal dimension for these unconstrained paths, but not for paths that have a fixed root. I can talk a bit about and it kind of appears to hold for large enough systems, this domain Markov property. What it means precisely, it means, I think, more elucidation and precise analysis. But we've tried different objects, different paths, to apply the same analysis path to a different pair, to really make sure that we understand what we're doing. You know, of course, it would be nice to look at a variety of curves using these types of tools, natural tools to look at these systems. So there is a conjecture for what kappa is by Hastings and Moore et al. I think they might be backing off that last I heard. So what are good tests? I don't mean that negatively. It's a very clever idea. I just don't know. That's my understanding of where we're at on that. What are good tests? We need to think, try out different things. I've given you a couple of tests. How can we test this? The idea is, I can't prove anything here, but can we come up with things that make it look like it's something looking into more precisely, where someone could do some more careful checks or some actual analysis and figure out better what's going on. We have some ideas about the domain Markov property. There's some very special things. These are minimizing paths on this graph, and these graphs have a hierarchical property and certain things that suggest that they're special. And it'd be interesting to understand better how you can modify SLE to replicate these different boundary effects. So thanks for your time.